Hi, I'm Bruce Greenwood, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio with Adam Shardoff.
Hey everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio. This is episode number 484 of the podcast. This is an episode dedicated to the recent Maryland Film Festival that took place a couple of weeks back. This is one of the better, smaller film festivals. Some of the best film festivals in this country are like Maryland Film Festival. And we're going to have on the executive director. I believe he is the founder or one of the founders of the festival. His name is Jed Dietz. And we recorded this conversation in the festival itself. And then we're going to meet with one of the filmmakers from the festival, an old friend of this podcast, Nathan Silver, will be on this episode. For those who wish to listen to past episodes that he's been on, Nathan was on episodes 148, 189, and 298. So it's been a while since he's been on. But finally, Nathan is back on the podcast. If you go to our YouTube channel, just go to YouTube and search Film Wax Radio, you can listen to the Nathan Silver playlist if you're a big fan. He's made quite a number of films, Nathan, and we'll come back to him in just a little bit. But first up here on this special edition of the show dedicated to the Maryland Film Festival is my conversation with the leader of the festival, Jed Dietz, here on Film Wax Radio.
Stuck here in Baltimore while you walk free. Luckier than one could claim a right to be. You and I just couldn't stand the sight of me. In Baltimore, I knew the
This is a podcast on the film industry. I bring on lots of people from, you know, the industry, not just filmmakers, but also programmers and distributors.
Great,
you
Fantastic.
Name it.
Tell me again what it is.
I will. I'll give you my card.
Yeah. Good.
Anyhow,
this is a totally fascinating world to me. And the ones, you know, like Mark Maron. I've found a couple because somebody recommending them the way they do.
I never heard of him.
I'm sure.
Actually, just talk right, because the noise, the background, it'll be easy to hear you if you talk right. That's perfect.
So it's a whole world that interests me a lot of podcasting, so this is great.
The nice thing about it is, of course, you can listen whenever it's convenient.
Yeah.
Which is, a major draw for why it's taken off as a,
People download them. They do just that, right? They download them and then listen to them in their car or on an airplane or something.
Yes. Yeah. You can listen to, anytime.
And you get data about who listens to you? Yeah. I mean, not just raw data like 800 people this one or...
Yeah, you do. You can
thousands. Yeah,
yes,
this other
there's,
one.
There's these companies that they provide what they call metrics. So you can subscribe. You plug in the necessary information they need, and then they can essentially track how many people are downloading or streaming your show by episode, geographically, as well as like what platform, what device. So but it's all by the IP address.
That's still fascinating.
So they can tell like if you're listening on a smartphone versus computer. If you're listening off a certain browser, it's all that information is there. I can't get any more specific than geography, like city, but they won't provide more than that.
So does that help you from a marketing? Do you market? Question.
It's not naive. You can, one thing I'm doing, but what I do is, since it's a niche show, it's not so general interest. I do try to make a certain amount of it. I might bring on as many famous people as I can, or well-known, people with names, so that I can attract Barry Levinson, for instance. We mentioned that would be somebody who I'd love to bring on as frequently as I can, because people know not only his name, but they know the body of his work, those titles. So that would be of more interest to people that aren't in the film world. So, but by and large, since I do a niche show,
I'm also looking for relationships. Like right now, I'm doing an outreach program to film schools and film programs. So to introduce the show to faculty and students, but also to it could be a possible way of getting a sponsor.
Fantastic.
You know, because so many film people listen to my show, that it could be a way to potentially reach young ears, you know, people that love film. Maybe they're looking for a graduate film program or to go back to school to a film program. They would be listening to my show.
Well, film, I mean, the demographic stuff you see from around the country with festivals, and the bigger ones do the best studies. Mm-hmm. The demographic of film festival audiences is quite diverse and also very powerful. I mean, they're real opinion leaders and...
Right.
You know, so that's a great. I mean, it should be really sellable to sponsors, which I don't know anything about.
I think so. You know, and I'm trying to reach out also to festivals like Maryland to create relationships with Maryland.
Yep.
With festivals, with Maryland too.
Right.
But with festivals because there's a natural synergy. There's first of all, I'm not trying to sell you any real estate, but like a festival could say we're. I literally have. I mean, countless filmmakers who listen to my show. You know, they love it because so many filmmakers come on the show. So I have, like, you know, Joe Swanberg here at the festival. He's agreed to sit and do it. You know, people are going to be interested. Like, Joe's figured out how to navigate and made a successful career for himself.
Of course.
But there are a lot of very talented filmmakers who are just kind of in an earlier stage but can look to his advice. So therefore, I would imagine if a film festival is wanting to reach filmmakers, I would be a good conduit for that, because whether you're trying to say, you know, submissions, early submissions coming up, late submissions, deadline is coming, you know, it's a great way for a lot of festivals to get the word out.
Yeah, great.
And it's becoming so competitive for so many. You've been around for 20 years, the Maryland Film Festival, we can plug that we're talking. But a lot of festivals are in their, you know, third, fourth, fifth years, and you wonder how do they get filmmakers to put themselves on their radar.
Right.
You know, well.
Well, it's, yeah. I mean, most of that, I think, is personal relationships. I mean, that's what I see happening.
Yeah.
And then you are either really good at what you do. It's like anything in life. You know, you're good at what you do, and that attracts people to you. Or the opposite happens, and, you know, only the relationships are left, you know.
Right.
But.
Yes, that's a good point. So, Jed, you've been with the festival from the beginning. Did you found it?
Yes, I did.
Okay. You founded the festival, and obviously it was, I'm going to guess, was it 1997? Or
99 was the first one, yep. April
backwards.
Of 99. So it's always, the idea was to always have it sort of end of April, first of May.
Okay.
We sort of settled on the first weekend of May every year.
Right.
Because Baltimore is sort of glorious looking then, you know, the azaleas are out and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
And so it's good inside the festival world. You know, you're sort of between Sundance and Cannes. Tribeca's happened already.
Right.
So it just seemed like a very good time for all those reasons.
Yeah. There's a big spring bunch of festivals that all seem to happen. But again, you have a little bit of, I think, an edge. Based on an incredible reputation.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's very nice to hear. I think what's special about the festival here is that we're really happy to be not a market festival. You know, we're not.
Yeah.
We never advertise that we've got the industry here. We have filmmakers here, and we have people who are interested in filmmakers. There's some press people who come regularly on their own and that kind of stuff. But I think we try to have this really be a moment. No competition, no awards, no categories. It's really a moment to really think about the art form in the best sense of the word, because there's always business around the art form. It's that kind of an art form. But really sort of talk to each other, gather together, and use each other, use the strength of the community. Right.
Yeah.
And I think there's tremendous strength in the community that's hard to see sometimes when you're making a movie, because it's a, by definition, sort of an isolated experience. You know, fundraising, shooting, casting, editing, all that stuff, marketing, is lonely. And I think there are lots of people around who know a lot about it and can share experiences, and that's what we try to do here.
Yes, and it's also of the size where you can actually have a substantial, you can have a substantial kind of experience, because it isn't a huge festival. It's a modest size.
Yeah, it's
festival.
A 5-day festival, and in the middle of Baltimore, and the audiences here also. The personality of Baltimore is so not pretentious, and yet very curious.
Well,
about
there's
things.
Always room for improvement. No, you don't want to be pretentious. I forgot. Yes, right, yeah.
Yeah, I hope we never are pretentious a city or a film festival. But I do think there's a curiosity here that filmmakers remark on all the time.
Yeah.
They get the Q&As here are very good because I think it's really about what the filmmaker's trying to do and the sort of, you know, what the industry impact and all that stuff is really for other places. And this is more about what the artist is trying to accomplish, what the filmmaker is trying to do, and connecting to audiences. And audiences are curious about that, what they're trying to do.
And also, because I can hear the film, and I'm sure you hear this all the time too, the filmmakers come because they just love coming to the festival. I mentioned before, earlier, Joe Swanberg, who comes every year,
yes,
whether he has a project or not.
Yes, it's true.
And so he just comes because for the love of the festival. And he lives in Chicago.
Yes.
So it's not like a two-hour trip here. Well, maybe it is a two-hour trip. It's just that it's by plane. And then, like, my friend Zach Clark, another filmmaker. He edited a film that's here, Michael Tully's film this year.
Yes.
But he comes also regardless. He's here just to support and to enjoy films, the festival.
Yeah,
And he knows that friends will show up.
Yeah, a number of filmmakers and others who are around filmmakers come and participate with us every year, whether we're showing a film of theirs or not. And I think it's because of the community that comes here and from the film world, just what you were saying earlier. I mean, I think it's a gathering place for filmmakers. That's a different atmosphere. And Sundance and Cannes, South By are hugely valuable to the film community.
Yeah.
This is also valuable just in a different way. I mean,
I agree, of the
older festivals, I would say the closest model is Telluride. And which is also a great festival and serves the community very well, their own community, but the film community very well. And that's been our goal from the beginning.
You mentioned the community, and I'm wondering, at this point, not that you can ever rest on your laurels about it, but, I mean, the reputation for the Maryland Film Festival, as we said, is pretty great. So how much effort, how much work goes into it every year, making sure that, you know, you just keep connected to the community, because people are coming out. I've been to a number of screenings here between last year and this year, and they're pretty well attended, even on a Thursday night, you know.
And even some of the more extreme or harder, you know, films.
Yeah, Canada, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, that might have, you know, the least commercial potential, which we never know at this stage of their life whether they have commercial potential or not.
That's what the programmer is hired to do.
Yeah, and we really look for... Our mantra is we program out of passion, not consensus. So we can have somebody on the top level of the programming team really wanting something, and I can hate it, and that's fine with me as long as somebody really is passionate, not likes, really passionate about a film.
Right.
And that has driven us from the beginning, and we've had a lot of film come through here that some of them have gone on to great commercial success and filmmakers who built careers, but that isn't why we programmed. We programmed because we love whatever that film was that they had just made.
The people, though, a certain percentage of your ticket sales are just Baltimore residents.
Yeah,
obviously a significant number.
Yeah,
correct?
mostly people from this region. Yeah,
sure, right. And they're maybe looking through the program. They're not going to know... I mean, yeah, they may have known your opening film last year, which I mentioned was Barry Levinson's film with,
Wizard of Lies.
Wizard of Lies, of course, with Robert De Niro and Michelle Pfeiffer. Who could forget? But by and large, they're going to open up the program. They're not going to recognize most of these filmmakers or the titles or care that it premiered at, you know, potentially at Berlin or something or Sundance. They're going to the films and buying tickets because they have the night free and they have the faith that they're going to have a great experience. Regardless of the film, is that a lot of people's experience?
No, I think that's
true. The average person.
Yeah, but I think you have the night free doesn't happen to anybody. I mean, you have to choose to have the night free.
Yes,
but I think that's because that's an interesting part of the step. I mean, I think people in this region are choosing to do this instead of something else they could be doing.
That's true, right.
And they're doing that because they're intrigued by this art form, and
they're proud of it too. I'm sure.
I think that's true. And I think but the discovery aspect, and now, you know, we, in a crazy way, in this world of streaming, we opened a movie theater last year, rescued a great 1915 movie theater, and
Parkway.
As we build the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Parkway, and as we build the audience for that, it's based on the same premise, that we're bringing movies that had never come to Baltimore, and our job is to get the word out to the community so that they can sort of decide when to dip in and choose once again to spend a night or spend a part of a night at the Parkway. And that's exactly what we do at the festival.
Mm-hmm.
The festival is a little easier because it's so many films. You can sort of bounce around and just say, look, I'm going to go down there. I know I'm going to see something, whether I like it or not, that's sort of intriguing. I'm going to learn something. I'm going to interact with filmmakers. But that spirit's also now alive here every day.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives us a chance to some of these not-so-commercial films that come through. There's now a window here in Baltimore, never was before, where they can come back. And we've brought filmmakers back all through the year, and they interact with audiences. It's been wonderful to sort of extend the spirit and mission of the festival.
So, in other words, the programming, even though the festival is sort of the if you want to call it the flagship or whatever you want to call it,
yep.
Event, but you have screenings, ongoing screenings throughout the year,
yes.
At the Parkway. As well, do you do theatricals of some of these as well, like week-long theatricals?
We give runs to things.
That's what I assume.
Yeah,
right.
And right now we're sort of experimenting with that because I think we don't have to be tied to week-long runs or month-long runs or whatever, you know, in the normal commercial movie world, theaters
sure.
and
right.
distributors argue about and negotiate. But we can, you know, we've done this already where we might have a film that we bring in for a few days and something happens during that we think, well, that should come back. We don't have room for it for a few weeks. The next month we bring it back for a few days.
Yeah.
And maybe the filmmaker comes that time, or maybe the filmmaker was here the first time and somebody else, the director and somebody else from the film comes in the next time.
Right.
And they meet with students in the area. It serves our community, the Baltimore regional community, in a variety of ways, both as a movie theater and as a way for emerging filmmakers in this community to meet with people who are out there right now with a film.
I see. Uh-huh. Well, last year I know another big success was Theo Anthony, Baltimore Sun, and Rat Film. The Rat
yeah.
Film was a great example. I think I saw that right after Barry Levinson. It was a nice kind of contrast.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it was the first feature film we showed at the Parkway was Wizard of Lies, which, you know, HBO was fantastic. Nobody'd seen it yet. I mean,
it
had De Niro and it had Michelle Pfeiffer and it had Barry Levinson directing, but truthfully, nobody really knew what they were going to see. And, you know, it's now everybody knows how fantastic that film is. And sadly, nobody else will get to see it on a big screen in a movie theater the way the audience did here.
That's true.
Because as good as it is on television, it's better in a theater on that big screen. I had seen it already. Barry had sent me a link, and I loved the film. But to see it hit that big screen in the Parkway with 400 people in the theater to watch it was thrilling. And I'm not criticizing HBO, but it's just it was made to be seen
sure.
through their distribution channel. So it just is unlikely you're going to get a chance again to see it in a movie theater.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's a whole other conversation. But it's interesting to talk to people about when it's being essentially produced by HBO, and you go in to make your film knowing it's going to be primarily seen on screen, you know, TVs, and maybe small screens and large screens, you know, but not necessarily movie screens. Like, how does that affect your approach to cinematically speaking or cinematography wise? You know. But
well,
that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah, and I just say it is a whole other conversation, and a big one and an evolving one. I mean, it's not,
right.
you know, tomorrow you might have a slightly different answer than you would give today to any of these things. But I hope as the great new forces that are coming into making movies, working with filmmakers on mm-hmm. making movies, Netflix and Amazon, et cetera, and HBO goes way back, but
right.
are
but
still evolving as we speak.
And still a front runner, yeah.
Yeah. I hope all of them start from their own vantage point, for their own use,
mm-hmm.
start thinking about theatrical as a way to help word of mouth get going and PR get going and stuff.
Right.
And we'll see.
Yeah.
I think that's all new, that world. And I think, you know, Amazon is certainly has some examples already, Manchester by the Sea, that where theatrical really...
Sure.
I mean, I don't know their numbers streaming, but I assume that's had a tremendous impact for them.
Yeah. I think they kind of see, since we're talking about it, a theatrical as being more of a significant part of the film's trajectory, whereas I think HBO doesn't have that investment quite. They always do special screenings, lots of special industry screenings or particular screenings.
Well, and
but they don't do typically theatricals before they show.
No, they've used the festival circuit some.
They regularly.
I mean, Sundance, certainly they premiered a lot of stuff at Sundance over the years, and Full Frame, they've done some stuff on the dock side. And
South By, often show like the first few episodes of a new series.
Yep.
It's not unusual for them to show the first three episodes, which might be like the length of a theatrical.
Yeah.
Of a feature, excuse me. Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean, I think these worlds can very much work together. Maybe not so much in the big chain groups, but in the independent movie theater world, I think they can definitely work together. And be good for the streaming services.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you. Well, I should have started by asking this question, but I'll close with it, and that is, what was your way in to the festival? I mean, you founded it. You just obviously feel there was this void that needed to be filled, you launched this great festival. But what was the background leading up to that? Did you have a film background?
No. It really came out of the business world. I have an MBA. I'd been in auto parts for a big chunk of time, and I raised a little money to help with script development, and that had just started. And then because of my wife, we moved to Baltimore. She's a pediatrician and got recruited by Hopkins to run their residency program. Anybody getting the film business, I recommend marry a doctor.
Noted.
And the film festival just grew out of working with the film office.
Right.
And we had no idea, really, when we started. We got funding enough for 3 years from a whole consortium. And the idea was, we'd see, is there an audience here that would respond to these new emerging films that you don't know anything about, many of them with actors that you've never heard of, et cetera, et cetera. And the community here responded right away. And we built it over the years, and then, you know, last year opened the SNF Parkway, and I think now the film culture is really bubbling in Baltimore. There's,
absolutely,
you know, the School for the Arts, a public high school, just started a film program that's really good. Hopkins and MICA, both college level, very good institutions, each very different from the other, are jointly doing some teaching and have just added graduate degree programs to their film departments and expanded. The Mellon Foundation's put in some money for youth media. Saul Zance is active in the community. I mean, since we started the construction on the parkway, just in the last few years, it's amazing what's happened with young people. And one of the things we're going to do, are doing, but will expand, is connecting these emerging filmmakers in our region to working filmmakers.
That's terrific. Excellent. Jed Dietz is the executive director?
Yeah.
And founder?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Both of those, yep.
Of the Maryland Film Festival, which is right now amidst its 20th season.
Correct.
And I hope maybe we can do this again at the 25th.
It'd be wonderful.
We don't have to wait that long, but
Yeah, nice. Come back to the Parkway sometime. Anytime we'll do this. Yeah,
I will. And I have family here now. So
perfect.
I stay with my cousin, and it's another reason why I find myself coming now.
That's great. Fantastic.
He's got a big smile on his face. Thank you very much. I really
thank you.
It.
Really appreciate it. It was fun.
Woke up today.
Nathan Silver, since he's been on, has become one of the most prolific, independent, low-budget filmmakers that I know. I think he is starting to become more ambitious in terms of the scale of his films. But that is not proven in this new film, which is called The Great Pretender. It is a terrific film. I can tell you I've seen a lot of growth in this filmmaker, going back to when I was first introduced to him with a film called Exit Elena, which came out or was made only 6 years ago. Since then, he has also made such films as Soft in the Head, Uncertain Terms, Stinking Heaven, Actor Martinez, Thirst Street, and now The Great Pretender. And The Great Pretender is a... the film is about the lives of a French theater director working and directing a production here in the States, played by Esther Gorell. Her ex-boyfriend, played by Linus Phillips, who has been on this show twice before. Her ex-boyfriend. And the two actors playing them, whose lives intersect dramatically in this tangled and darkly funny roundelay set in the New York theater world. As I mentioned, the film is directed by Nathan Silver. It's co-written by Jack Dunphy. It's and shot by Sean Price Williams. The film is produced by our friends over at Brick in Brooklyn. Is still in the festival circuit. We'll keep up with the film and we'll keep you apprised of what happens with it. But without any further delay, here's our old friend of the podcast, filmmaker Nathan Silver.
Eat up, little cedar. Looking everywhere, hard times in the city, in a hard town by the sea. Ain't nowhere to run to, there ain't nothing here for free.
Feeling of being at a festival, which we're at.
We're at a festival.
You're back for how many times have you been at the? How many times have you been at the Maryland Film Festival?
It's my fourth movie here, but my third time being here physically.
Oh, for some reason I thought you were here more times than you were. No, but you're. No. Yeah.
I never, oddly enough, I never submitted my early movies. I should have.
I don't know. You're still figuring that out, right? Probably at the time, or you weren't intimidated by the idea of submitting a film to. You're probably submitting to Sundance. Thank you.
There'll be a lot of
shit to cut out now.
No, are you kidding me? Anyway, but I made it to this film minutes ago called The Great Pretender.
Yeah.
Over at the Parkway Cinema.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was fun. It was great to catch up. It makes two in a row now because last year I saw Thirst Street there, and now I just saw Great Pretender.
Yeah, on the massive screen. I love that. It's so funny because it was made to be a web series at first. So
is that true?
Yeah.
What happened?
We had a feeling early on in the pre-production process that it would turn into a feature, and then after a few days of production, we were almost certain. But when we first talked about it to our
DP, you were formulating it.
Yeah, and it was pitched as a web series. That's where we got the financing from.
Oh,
yeah, from Brick.
Right,
yes.
Right.
So they
that would make
it.
Sense that it would have been on Brick TV. I saw the Aziz and everybody on there. Yeah.
Wow.
Right, and that they probably could maybe financially speaking a web series that would also be something they could think they could actually have substantial help give substantial help in.
Yeah,
if they pitched it as a film, they would say, "Well, we're not going to be able to give enough to."
Exactly. So, but
as it turns out,
yeah. It worked. I mean, they were very supportive throughout.
Right.
It ended up working out. It's a movie.
So how did you are you going to do a screening there? I don't know.
I don't know how it's going to work in the end.
Because they have that TV station channel.
I think it'll be on that station at one point.
Yeah, it better be. I would imagine that's they're going to want you to make good on that promise.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then last year when I was watching Thirst Street, I was sitting with John Waters.
Yes.
Just so happened.
Yeah.
And he had a really good time. I was looking for him today.
Yeah, I didn't see him.
That's a bummer.
I know.
You were kind of hoping, right?
I was hoping, of course. You know, a hero.
He's going to be here later with showing Olga.
Yeah.
Right? Anyway, so, but this one, even though it was conceived as a web series, you obviously made this real, this is your typical style. You shoot fast, right?
Yes.
Had you even started it last year before Maryland?
We were in the throes of pre-production when I came to Maryland.
Oh, okay.
Because we shot in June, last June.
Right.
I mean, what happened was basically after Thirst Street, I had this, a bunch of notes about this story, and I sent them to Jack, and Jack wrote...
Dunphy?
Jack Dunphy.
Yeah.
And he ended up writing the pilot script for what was to be a series. And then we kind of started shopping that around, and it landed at Brick.
Was the web series, the idea supposed to be on like a just, I don't think I'm using this term right for it, but gestation of a... Of a play,
yes, it was the same structure, identical structure. It would have been five, you know, episodes, and culminating in the play,
right?
So
it would have breathed a little bit more, perhaps, because it would have been. It might have breathed a little bit more because it would have been
side characters. There were more side characters.
They were written out.
Yeah,
I see. Okay, so I'm going to do a lousy job if I describe the story, but essentially you have these two people get caught up who are kind of in a relationship. And in the same time, you have the characters in the play, right?
So basically,
and they're kind of interwoven.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's,
I suppose.
You have this French woman, Mona, who comes to New York to stage a play about her relationship with this guy, Nick, this older photographer who left his wife for her.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so she makes this play about her relationship with him, and she casts an actor who she ends up having a romantic fling with, and... The actress playing her falls in love with the actor playing her ex, and it's like a love quadrangle because she has to contact her ex at a certain point, so it all becomes very extraordinarily messy for them.
Right, and all manners of romantic pain and hilarity.
We wanted to make melodrama.
I could see that. So, did you have some of your influences? I don't know if you had any here.
I mean, yeah, all the time. Like Fassbinder and Cirque in my brain. They're
hardwired.
Yeah, hardwired in my brain. Uh-huh. But we were watching this movie by Pierre Clémenti for visual purposes and in terms of, I don't know, when we were writing it, I wasn't so much thinking about the influences, but then when I started meeting up with Sean, the DP, we just watched like a shitload of movies at his apartment, and some things stuck. And there was this movie called New York After Midnight, I think, by this these French dudes who came to New York and made some cheap movies back in the 80s.
Oh.
There were two in a row, and one of them is just straight pornography. The other one is kind of has a thriller element to it. But the way they lit certain scenes fascinated me, and I thought about this nostalgic quality that you have for a city that you've never visited or that you've only spent a bit of time in because you've grown up watching it in movies.
Right.
And for this Parisian coming to New York, and she has this idea of it only through cinema in a few years she lived here. So I liked giving the whole our movie this nostalgic sense, and that's why it's very hazy and kind of, you know, gauzy.
Yeah.
And all the lighting is unmotivated by... It's not motivated...
Some of that was... I remember also in Thirst Street, though.
Yeah. I'm obsessed with the past. I mean, I feel like we're... I don't know what it is right now, but it feels...
Your past? The past that? You know, or the past that you see in cinema?
The past that I've seen in cinema.
And in books and photos.
It's more about the past that I've seen
too,
in cinema.
Yeah.
Because now I realize that I associate emotion with that past that I've seen in cinema, and I have no emotional attachment to my recent past.
Right.
Like, what I see around seems so kind of... It's not evocative. I remember New York, when I first moved to it in, 2001, 2002, I have a very... They're very... I have all of these wonderful memories from that time, but after that, New York just seems like a blur. I have nothing... No real attachment to any of the sites that I used to, go frequent, and it just... feels pretty bleak in terms of what exists. You go to the East Village, and there's not even a fucking bookstore you can you can't hang out at. I used to go to Kim's and just hang out for hours. You know, I used to go to St. Mark's Bookshop and hang out for hours. I would go to the video stores and bookstores, and now it's just I don't know, it's restaurants. You have to go spend money or, you know, just drink.
Right. Or Starbucks.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree.
I mean, this is like the cliche. That's the funniest part. Like, but it's so terribly on the nose that it feels like we're living, you know, when you're living in a cliche, you feel like you're living in a nightmare. That's why, I don't know, New York has lost a lot of its luster for me. I mean, I've been living there for like 17 years, and it's just, I don't know.
But you're also, you know, if we're transitioning the conversation into your life a little bit, you spend an awful lot of time on the road.
Yes.
And I think that maybe that appeal also is this place you're at where yeah. you're kind of like disenchanted maybe with home.
I mean, the kicks I get out of being in New York are when I'm around, you know, my friends, and there are certain nights that feel like New York nights again yeah. where we're up mm-hmm. until like, you right. know, sunrise, and it just feels like that kind of sense I had when I first got to the city. But for the most part, I just like, I don't know. It's pretty bleak.
It's bleak point we're at. I agree. I mean, I think this comes up a lot, and I feel the same way. I said, yeah. You know, when you graduate, when you go off to school, you know, I'm out of here. And he goes,
yeah.
What? Yeah. The New York I grew up in, this doesn't remotely.
And we sound like old.
Resemble that. I know.
We sound like old men, and I'm like 34.
But I am one. You're young.
Well, kind of. I'm about to turn 35. I don't know, but
that's a good age, though. That's a really good age.
Kind of.
You're coming into yourself completely.
I guess so, yeah. But if coming into yourself means coming to terms with the fact that.
No, it's more internal.
It's more internal.
Well, you know, you find a voice, you find a. You know, your essence is completely.
I suppose, it's like living in that cinematic past. Which, you know,
yeah.
which flourishes. And I think it flourishes at times when you don't really want to look at what's around you.
Yeah. So you're making films. Do you feel like you're making films so you're honoring that for future generations also? Or even
no,
just
I'm
your
just,
own sense of...
It's so happy. I can have some
yeah.
hope.
Yeah.
So I'm like turning to the past, the cinematic past for hope, you know?
Yeah.
But it's also, I mean, that's not ever like a conscious... It's never done consciously. It's just, it's always like, you know, you work from the gut. When you work at a fast clip, so it's like always working from the gut, and you want to make things beautiful. You want to add light where there's no light, so you add
right.
bizarre streaks of light, and then somehow it just changes the space that you're shooting. There are these, you know, most of the apartments you shoot in are just these boxes. So how do you make them interesting? You have to add texture through light. You can't really. There's no depth to them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like all the spaces that we're living in are so boring. I mean, in a bar when the lights are on. It's pretty bleak, and I feel like that's what
yeah,
our existence is now. It's like
yeah.
It's like we're living in a bar with the lights on, and we just have to look at each other. We can't be drunk and see like
right.
when you're drunk,
soft light.
Yeah. So I want to in the movies, I want it to be soft light and then a harsh reality,
mm-hmm.
in terms of like what the characters are going through.
So coming back to The Great Pretender, which I kind of like now the name all the more because. It's about pretending. It's about
yeah.
the point is. It seems like in the play is where I kind of felt like where everything comes to a sort of a crescendo. There,
yeah.
everything comes to a certain right
yes.
point where all of a sudden they're improvising. They're actually you're playing out their real relationships right on the stage
yeah.
and all, and you have really made it into kind of like a satire almost
yeah.
like right at a certain point. Poor Keith Paulson, he's no actor. He admits that he's. I don't know if I'm. Giving away stuff I shouldn't, but I don't think it matters so much. I mean, I don't
yeah.
think so, but let me know.
Yeah, of course.
But he admits that he's never done. He's not
yeah,
an
his
actor.
Character's never acted before.
His character hasn't.
I mean, that's
Keith,
all. That, yeah,
Keith's
yeah,
character,
yeah, yeah,
yeah. Not
Keith
the character
Paulson.
Within
Keith
the character.
Paulson acts a
right?
lot.
I know. Now I'm confusing myself. The play within the film, and then he panics, and then Linus Phillips, who plays the
real ex
the real life. Yeah, the real. Yeah. comes in and becomes the actor in the play. It's kind of a nice, just nice poetry there.
It was something like Jack and I had discussed, but then we didn't know how it would actually work on paper. And then we had multiple versions of it, and finally it clicked into place.
That's funny.
You know, right before the shoot, Jack came with a new draft, and it just like it all. We knew that all these elements had to collide.
Yeah.
At the end, but we just didn't know in what because he wrote it section by section.
Uh-huh.
So it was, you know, it was kind of, it wasn't like a full script that was delivered
right,
to me
right, right, because, you were creating as you in other words.
No, I mean, we had the full script by the time we shot, but what I mean to say is that he would deliver, like, the Mona section, then Chris's section, then Therese's section, then Nick's section, then the play. So like it was each one we would rewrite, like we would get it to a point we liked, and then we would move on to the next one.
Oh, okay. And that's kind of how it's presented too in the chapters.
Yes. It was always structured that way.
I see, right, because it was a series. So you kind of kept that structure in place. Interesting, okay. So you have two or three things coming up, films, production. I'm kidding around.
Yeah, I mean, well, we're doing reshoots for this movie that was called, it used to be called The Pervert. Uh-huh. We're uncertain of the title at the moment, but we're doing reshoots next week, and then we'll be editing that all summer. And, that I'm co-directing with Jack Dunphy, and then I'm writing scripts. I've grown exhausted of making micro-budget affairs. It's just been one after another, and it becomes it's emotionally draining, and so I'm trying to take a little bit more time because I want to be able to actually have some money to put into preparation, because these things, you are doing them around, you're working on so many other things at the same time as you're preparing, that when you get to production, so much has to come together during production. I would love to have some more preparation. I'd love to have more shoot days. I'd love to have elaborate shots that, you know, I can actually dream about for a bit of time instead of just like vomit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's not that it's vomited out. It's just like that's
maybe
how it feels after a while.
Maybe use a different term.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. I know what you mean, though. But it seems like such a decision, a conscious choice that you've made to work in this very quick way to be really, really prolific. Was it just this sense of urgency that you felt had to feed it? Is that why you've been doing it? Because you've come out with like a film a year, like the last 5 years or something like that.
7 years.
Seven, excuse me.
So it's just been,
that's
exhausting.
Insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, but
it's your choice. You didn't have to do that.
I didn't have to do it, but
you were caught up in a
wave. I don't have to do it consciously, but I mean, like the problem is that the filmmaking is so fraught, like it's so full of rejection, getting rejected from festivals, getting rejected from, like, getting, you know, negative reviews, just being told off, making very little money. So what you do in order to basically continue working is, before those things are even on the table, because you're still editing one movie, you start preparing the next one.
Mm-hmm.
So because if not, like, you might wait until you hear, like, you see how badly the movie does festival-wise or theatrically, and then you're heartbroken and you don't want to move on to the next one. So it's like a way of self-protection. You know, it's a way to protect myself.
Yeah, and also because you're going through all this painful breakup with the city of New York.
I understand. I think like it's just, you know, the last few years have been odd. There have just been.
And now, by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I want to come right back to your thought, but I understand by extension your love of, what I gather is a love of Paris.
Yes.
I get it.
But it's a museum of a city.
Right.
The great Paris
it's
lived
never,
in the past.
You can't just put steel glass everywhere and get rid of all everything and replace everything with CVS.
Yeah.
They won't stand for it.
They won't, but it's still like a museum of a city.
Yeah.
It's not a... When I went there when I was, you know, 25, I went there to study filmmaking and I ended up dropping out of the program because it was so awful, but I felt so bored there after being in New York because it's just like it feels so dead. But then, you know, going back and shooting Third Street there, I realized like I want to be in a museum of a city. It was very pleasurable. But then, of course, you know, all the fucking French want to come to New York, and they're sort of like they would desire
like wife swap.
I know,
city swap,
city swapping.
Yeah,
but you know, I don't know. There's something about it now that really I find really appealing. I have very good friends there, and it kind of puts me at ease. Like I go and just. I feel a bit. Maybe it's like I'm ready to be an adult. I'm ready to enter the museum of the city instead of being in a place which I thought was like full of life, thriving and insane, chaotic. Mm-hmm. Paris feels a little better.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
I mean,
7 years ago, you were in a different. You're a very young guy, and you're still a young guy, as I mentioned. But
yeah.
But you know, it's where your head's at.
Yeah.
You know.
But it's weird to. I guess these movies all reflect, obviously, because they're made at such a rapid pace, they reflect whatever given mental state I'm in at the time. And so after a while, you just start to, you sit with, like, I'll watch a movie I made from a few years ago at, like, if there's a college screening or something, just to see what the hell it is, because I don't remember.
Really?
And then I'm like, I don't know what caused me to make that. I don't know what caused, like, I don't know where the ideas come from. It's never some rational. It shouldn't be, I don't think. You know, because I think if anything is rational, it's kind of boring from the get-go. Like, I get bored by anything that seems like it makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, it's always struggling to figure out exactly what to do next. But it's always working against what I've just done and trying to figure out how to either improve it, pervert it, distort it. Like, I don't even know what to do, but like, somehow work with what I've just made because I don't want to get bored.
Well, no, I interrupted you before. I'm sorry because I can't. I was going to try to remember where you were going. So, but anyway, lastly, I don't know how you managed to talk your mom off the ledge in this case because I just saw her for a second in an audience, literally in the theater audience of scene that I was talking about before. Where everything comes to a head with your four main characters. Yeah. And there was a shot of the audience at the end clapping because it's, you know, it's just this satirical moment where, and everybody loves all this. And they don't necessarily think it's actually written as the play, right? Or they may. I don't know. It's up to us to figure out. Yeah. Yeah, I guess. But anyway, so she didn't get a talking part. She must have been bothered.
She had a part in the movie, and then we had to cut out the scene because it didn't make sense. Yeah.
She hates when you do that.
I know. I already did. With actor Martinez, she said that caused her to, you know, go into a deep depression. She blames me for that.
It might have been the timing also, though, back then.
No. She says it's...
again? Really?
I mean, I'm joking.
Back then, she was in a
It was a bad time, yeah.
Yeah.
It was cut out of a movie.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to make a movie about my mother's hatred of acting and how she also needs acting and how it caused her to go into a deep depression when I cut her out of the movie.
She was hanging on to that, obviously, for some reason. Yeah. It was so important to her. Oh, well.
In any case.
You wrote a very nice part in Thirst Street. So this goes out. So I have to say this. We'll dedicate this segment to Harvey Silver.
Exactly. My father, I mean.
Who was also in that theater shot.
He's a wonderful man.
Yeah. Where is this playing next? We can hold on to this segment until...
I don't know where it's playing next.
I don't really know.
Honestly don't know because we've just started submitting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right, very good. Well, the name of the film is called The Great Pretender. Director is still Nathan Silver. And end of scene.
Thank you.
Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. Don't forget to leave a nice little review. You know, I always say if you leave a star or on Stitcher too. We were having problems, by the way, now that I mentioned Stitcher. We were having a technical problem, which I wasn't even aware of because, you know, I have an iPhone and I generally deal with iTunes. And so I wasn't checking up on Stitcher. And then I just arbitrarily went to our Stitcher account and lo and behold, it was like 20 episodes behind. Nobody brought this to my attention, sadly. So I apologize. If you are not an iTunes or Apple person, you're maybe a Galaxy phone user or some other phone, you can download the Stitcher app. It's a wonderfully designed app. I mean, aesthetically, just visually and otherwise, it's a great app. It works really well. As of now, the issue was rectified. You can now hear back episodes right up to our current episode. Probably even this very episode that you're listening to now will be available on Stitcher. And by the way, even if you have iTunes, you can also go on Stitcher. I know some podcasters put bonus content on their Stitcher accounts. And then it's like there's you can pay for Stitcher or get the free version. So it's a smart thing to do. Anyway, thank you for listening. Thank you for writing a review. You know, the show, if you do write it, whether on Stitcher or iTunes, it will come up more frequently. And also, you know, the show is, every segment has been up, is getting uploaded, I should say, is, because it's a process, to our YouTube channel. Go to YouTube and search Film Wax, and our channel will come up, and you'll see I'm populating the channel with lots of back segments. So you can listen to any segment individually. You don't have to listen to an entire episode if you prefer. Right now, I'm also creating playlists. So Nathan, who was on this episode, will have a playlist with all of his four visits played in one playlist. So you could actually listen to like 2-3 hours of me talking with Nathan. And by the way, his mother, because Cindy Silver, who is his mother, who has been on in several of his movies, was in one, had a substantial role in one of his films, and they both, the first time Nathan came on, he brought his mother to the studio, and we actually talked, we had them both on. It was a lot of fun. So there'll be that. And as I catch up, we'll be just, we'll also maybe do playlists by theme or other things like that as well. Give people an opportunity to listen to Film Wax Radio the way they choose and prefer. Anyway, it's just one way that I'm trying to pay attention to the needs and preferences of my listeners. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, as I mentioned, YouTube. Follow us and friend us. Please do engage with all things Film Wax Radio. This has been Film Wax Radio episode 484. All right. Thank you very much. Please do take care of yourself and the ones you love. Until next time, take care. Broken lines, broken strings.